We're here for argument in the Department of Transportation of the State of Colorado versus Gypsum Ranch, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
If it please the court, Senior Assistant Attorney General Larry Tannenbaum, appearing on behalf of the Department of Transportation. Seated at council table with me is Eric Meyer, Assistant Attorney General, also representing the Department of Transportation. This chair is apparently has been provided for me. I am having some back issues to just in case, and I'm going to try not to use it.
I'll feel free to use it.
Well, I'm going to, if I start having problems, I'll just let you know ahead of time that I'm going to move into it then.
Okay.
From 1917 until 2006, during that period of time, this appears to be, at least from CDOT, and I'll refer to my client as CDOT, seems to be the first time that CDOT is aware of where there has been a challenge to the estate and land that CDOT acquires when it condemns property in an eminent domain proceeding or a settlement. From 1917 until the ruling by the Court of Appeals in the case below, CDOT, the General Assembly, and condemnees have always acted in accordance with the belief that CDOT acquired a fee simple estate, including the mineral estate and the subsurface estate in condemnation proceedings, except when there was a reservation of the mineral estate or any other estate in either the conveyance instrument, be it a deed, or in a rule and order, which is the final order in an eminent domain proceeding.
That's a fairly large statement you made there, though. I mean, you weren't there all those years.
I wasn't there, no.
My question is this. Is it the customary practice to have a bargaining between CDOT before the 19, the very recent amendment, between CDOT and the landowner over whether it would be a right-of-way or a full fee simple interest, including the mineral estate? And how was that reflected in the condemnation values that were appraised before the condemnation occurred?
I can point you to the record in this case as an example. In any condemnation proceedings, there's a process in place. There's a negotiation. Well, even before that, there's a process to ascertain how much property is necessary for any given project. Plans are drawn up, legal descriptions are drawn up before there's ever an attempt to have a discussion with a landowner. Under both federal and state law, there is an offer made. There's actually a notice. This is a little more current practice, but a notice is sent out advising a party that the department is considering to take, that their land may be needed for a particular highway project. There's an appraisal. And then subsequently, and in fact, the owner is advised of a right to an appraisal. And an offer is made. And there is a process for having negotiations, and there are a lot of decisions from this court as to what are good faith negotiations and not. But the bottom line is that the parties don't resolve the case by negotiations, and a condemnation is filed. And the record in this case shows that some of the cases were resolved, and some of the cases weren't, which necessitated the filing of a condemnation proceeding. The record in the underlying Hunt case shows that there was a condemnation case filed. There were appraisals that are part of the record.
Do they include the appraisal of the mineral estate?
The appraisals that were used in this case were a form appraisal. It's pretty clear that the appraisers appraised a fee simple estate. There's a document from the appraiser for Ms. Hunt also referencing that it was a fee. And I understand that that doesn't necessarily mean what it says, but it seems as if the entire estate was looked at. And
Mr. Simon, can I ask you about that? I just sort of exactly understand it. It seemed in looking at the petition that was filed in condemnation on paragraph 9, it talks about at least giving notice to Johnny Dunn and Atlantic Richfield of a possible oil and gas lease.
That's correct.
And what does that, to me, I mean, that would indicate at least there was some aspect of the mineral estate was being at least notified of the condemnation.
And as I recall, some of these parties entered appearances to protect whatever interest they may have had by oil and gas leases. In the ensuing 12 years, I guess we could say they sort of dropped out of the litigation. They were no longer there at the end. And one can only make assumptions or inferences as to why they were no longer there. The one that seems most obvious is that there wasn't really, at that point in time, any interest that they felt necessary to assert.
Is there anything in Exhibit A that would indicate that this is fee simple? I mean, I can't, it's three pages of legal description, which I have never, frankly, understood, nor want to. But is there anything?
Except for the purposes of this case.
Well, I want some explanation. Is there anything that indicates that it was fee simple?
Well, if one takes a look at, and if you want, I can get right into the statute, but even without going there, there's more than one legal description here. And if one looks at the petition itself, it indicates, and in the original petition, we have parcel 415. Later was revised and then revised again, and it became parcel 415 revised 2, which is the legal that was attached to the final rule and order in 1987. If you go on in the rest of what's called Exhibit A, you'll also find on the third page a permanent easement. There are two of them, actually, E-415 and E-415A, in describing the purpose for the use of those easements as utility easements. There's even a temporary easement. And then there's an access control line. I guess I'm used to calling this the fee parcel, but it clearly, there are no words of limitation in this whatsoever. This describes a definite place that one can, if one could somehow take this, and if you were a surveyor, you could figure out where on the ground this property lays, would also cover whatever lies underneath it. And I suppose one could say, if one were thinking of air rights, one could say what lies above this. But there's no words of limitation calling this an easement or anything else.
Mr. Tannenbaum, let me ask you another preliminary question, and that is, can you comment on whether it is also generally the practice to obtain only the judgment, as was done in this case, and not to actually have a executed transfer of rights and a title issued?
Well, it would vary from case to case. Okay. Again, if you look at the record in Hunt, and I can't tell you that Hunt represents every piece of highway in the state that CDOT's ever been involved in constructing, but at least it appears as if it's somewhat representative. You have some deeds where the parties were apparently able to reach agreement. And in this case, most of those deeds were special warranty deeds. You have a few little oddities, like there was a deed, I think the railroad was Union Pacific, where permanent easements were taken. And then you have rules and orders. I think there were actually about 28 rules and orders in the record below, which meant the condemnation was filed. Not all of those went to trial, but some of those went to trial, and some were settled, as in the Hunt case. It took about 12 years and a lot of, I hate to say mishaps in the case, but I've read the record, and there are a lot of delays and this and that, but after 12 years, the case settled very quickly by an agreement between the parties, a consent, which is also in the record. And so it can vary. And I can't tell you that there's any rule of thumb as to how many settlements there'll be in a given project versus how many cases will be litigated. At least from what I've been able to observe in the years I've been doing this, there are a lot more cases that are settled and deeds convey the property than there are cases that are filed in court for eminent domain.
Yes, but it raises a different question, which is, you know, in the Antero brief, they mentioned some concern about collateral attack on a judgment. The other parties don't really focus on that at all, sort of leading me to believe that they think that's, you know, not an issue and that there isn't a problem with that approach, with that attack here. But no one, I think, has quite walked us through why, and I wonder if you could do that.
I'll do my best. That was more or less an issue in the trial court, less of an issue in the Court of Appeals, because Judge Boyd in his entry of the order didn't get into it, but we had raised an issue of waiver. This case, the underlying case is old, there's no doubt. It was filed in 1975. It finally concluded in 1987. It didn't even appear to be that complex, but circumstances were such that the case dragged on. There was no, it appears from the record, there was no effort on the part of Ms. Hunt to seek the mineral estate. There was a big fight over gravel that went on for years and years and years, and the judge finally ruled on that. And then very quickly, a new attorney entered his appearance in the case on behalf of Ms. Hunt, and very quickly the case settled. And then the case sat. There was no longer a case, but this property was acquired, and in fact, probably the highway was built a decade before the case settled, because there was a possession order very early, and it was probably in 1975. So the property was built, CDOT had possession of the property for 12 years, and then the rule and order was entered, which the statute treats as if it were a deed, and then that's all that happened. The only other events that seem to be in the record that happened since were in 1990, Gypsum Ranch acquired property, the Hunt property, and then nothing happened again for another 6 years. And then all of a sudden, the Garfield County Quiet Title action was filed, so in 1996. So we have that period of just mathematically, it sat for a long time, from essentially almost 20 years with nothing happening. We raised an issue of waiver. We also raised the issue of whether, in fact, in the lower court, Ms. Hunt waived any rights there would be and that would bind her successors in title by not raising the issue. She had every opportunity to raise the issue of the subsurface mineral estate. If one looks at the record that was provided by Gypsum Ranch in the trial court below. And essentially what that amount, there was an affidavit by an individual named Hubble, and he attached recorded documents from point A to point B. And I want to say it was between rifle and silt, but I'm not sure I hate to commit to that because I don't know the geographics of it that well. But essentially between two points and these various instruments were there, it's clear that some people reserve minerals, particularly in the deeds. And Ms. Hunt didn't. So that issue was raised. It was never ruled upon. I mean, it would still be our position today that there was a waiver, that issue was available and could have been litigated and was never apparently raised. There was a big fight over gravel, but that's really a far cry
so
from the
I was sort of looking for more of an explanation for why it isn't an issue, so maybe it surprises me a little bit to hear you suggest that it is, but I guess that you would just say procedurally perhaps it isn't because that hasn't been raised, preserved, ruled on.
Exactly. Judge Boyd entered his ruling, Gypsum Ranch appealed. That issue really wasn't, as I recall, part of any of the appellate proceedings, and then we have one somewhat narrower issue in front of this court right now. So, yeah, the issue's out there. If for some reason or another this case were ever to end up back in front of Judge Boyd, that would probably still be an issue. At least we would feel like we'd want to raise that issue, and we certainly raised it, as I recall. It's been several years, but I seem to recall we raised that issue in our motion for summary judgment. is there any more I can do on that issue?
All right, you should probably.
But, well, you characterize, though, the custom and practice, and I think it's important the agency's interpretation of its enabling power. Was there any time or era when the Department of Highways, as it was then known, was just seeking a right-of-way, as we would understand, maybe a ditch right-of-way, just the right of passage through for the structure rather than the fee estate? Or are you saying that all the way back, the Department of Highways was taking the position that it could and would acquire fee whenever possible?
I don't think that it's so much a question of era. I think it's a question of the particular exigencies of a project. There's a reported case called First Place. And in that case, this was near Central City, and I think it's highway, I may butcher the highway number. I want to say it's 19 or 119, but what were given in those cases were right-of-way deeds. And those were construed to be rights-of-way. In that particular project, or at least in those that particular situation, there was a lesser interest acquired. As I mentioned with the railroad, even in the record in this case, there were permanent easements that were acquired, and those could be for any number of reasons. I think the starting point would be, yes, the practice was to take a fee simple estate. That's CDOT's belief that that's what it had the authority to take, what the estate and land was that its authority allowed it to take, and in given situations, and even in some of the deeds in this case, it took somewhat less, because in some of the deeds in this case there was a mineral right reserved. And actually, Mr. Mulhall represented some individuals, and I want to say their name was Schaefer, and in that case it was a rule and order. Mr. Mulhall actually reserved water rights and easement, so something less than the entire, shall we say, the bundle of sticks, which is the entire fee simple, in some cases less than the bundle of sticks were either sought or agreed to, either at the time of negotiations or by the time an eminent domain proceeding concluded.
Mr. Tamron, in your reply brief, you make the general distinction and then give some examples of it. I guess I'd like to hear your argument about why the eminent domain authority that you cite is for CDOT is substantive, and that the authority that Gibson Ranch cites is just general procedural administrative statutes. I think to me this is a statutory construction case.
I agree with your honor that this is. I think this is.
So I want to get clear on your position.
I agree entirely.
The history is nice, but.
I understand. This is a statutory construction case, and that's probably the major task here, is to construe the statutes that are at issue in this case. And the authority statute goes back to 1917. At that time, the Department of Transportation was created. As a result of there being a Federal Highway Aid Act in about 1915 or 16, mandated that the states, in order to get federal funding, have highway departments. The General Assembly here very quickly created a department. There hadn't been one previously, and there probably hadn't been a need previously. But in 1917, there was a department created, and eminent domain authority was provided. And over the years, that eminent domain authority has really changed very little. It's essentially all the same. And the authority provided.
Is it in 40? Your argument is based on 43.1208, subsection 3, the word.
That is correct.
And has that changed?
It's changed very little since 1917.
Well, we're really talking 1973 when this thing happened, right?
Yeah, and essentially in 1973, the statute was pretty much the same
statute that was there?
Pretty much, yeah. It's essentially the same thing. It said that CDOT can acquire.
So, why is that a substantive statute as opposed to a procedural statute in the 38 section?
Well, in Title 43, this is substantive because this is CDOT's, the statute creating and creating CDOT, and also providing the various powers and duties of CDOT and its various officers and subparts. And it clearly says that the Transportation Commission, which is the governing body of the Department of Transportation, has the authority to proceed to acquire the lands of private persons for state highway purposes under and according to the eminent domain statute. In other words, you have the power to acquire the lands of private persons, and you acquire those for state highway purposes. How do you do that? You use the eminent domain statute as your procedure for doing that. That's essentially how the General Assembly has looked at the authority and how the authority has remained until 2008, essentially for 91 years. And we went further. We took a look at the word lands. What does that mean? What did the General Assembly mean when it said lands? Well, the one thing the General Assembly's had in effect, even prior to statehood, was a definitional statute. That it said, unless the context requires otherwise, these definitions apply in construction of all statutes. And word lands, or the word land, lands or real estate, has been defined not only by the first General Assembly in 1877. We found that in 1868, the Territorial General Assembly had the same definition and almost all the same set of definitions. And land is defined, there are four parts to that. The first part is land. And actually, the word land alone, just alone, the word land is entirely consistent with a fee simple estate. I'd cite you to the Fryco case, which is in the briefs. There's a case from this court called O'Brien versus Village Land, 794 Pacific 2nd, 246. Land is, and those the definitions is a fee simple estate, but you add in land, tenements, hereditaments, and all rights thereto and all interest therein. So that would cover every subpart. That definition is a fee simple estate.
Counsel, can I get you to, let's say you're right about lands, can I get you to address some of the other statutory provisions? I know your general overall argument, but some of the limitations perhaps on your authority, can I get you to address those sections?
Sure. I did want to reserve some rebuttal.
You may, but I'm really hoping okay. You can get to the other sections
okay.
Before you
sit down.
Okay,
you want me to address which statutes now?
Well, I guess just your argument on Section 381.1054, I guess,
okay.
The right-of-way. Just help me understand, you're saying this isn't a right-of-way, so that doesn't apply. Just help me understand that argument.
All right, if one takes a look, the definition, 381.1054, essentially says that the condemnor at the end of the proceeding becomes seized in fee simple. In other words, acquires the property in fee simple in the first sentence. And the second sentence says if a right-of-way or easement is being acquired, then you can never acquire, it uses vein ledge, in other words, the mineral estate. Since it's pretty clearly qualified, it says if an easement or a right-of-way is being acquired, it's been our position, and we briefed this throughout, that there are two definitions of right-of-way. If one looks at Title 43 and all the various statutes, it's absolutely clear that the term right-of-way is being used to describe the use of the highway, not and its location. It's not being used to describe an easement. If it were otherwise, all of the statutes regarding sale, disposition of property would all be meaningless, because those provide for granting title. There's never a title to an easement. You don't have title if you have an easement. And you don't, there would be no reason for the chief engineer to be able to grant a deed for any rights, because when the purpose of an easement is over, if it were no longer needed for state highway purposes, there would be no easement. It would be gone, and the property would revert. So it's pretty clear that sentence doesn't even apply.
Okay, how about 431.209?
Yes, and I've looked at that.
Yeah, okay, I'm glad. Tell me what your interpretation of that portion is.
And that talks about subsurface support. And again, this is a statutory construction case, so it's necessary to do some sort of trying to construe these statutes in para materia. In other words, it's necessary to try to reconcile these. It appears to me, and it appears to be, this is a case where there's subsurface support required, which is, anytime you own a mineral estate, as a matter of law, and all the case law says that. You have to provide support for the surface estate. In a case where CDOT doesn't acquire the subsurface estate, and as we've seen from the record here, there were several number of cases actually where the subsurface estate wasn't acquired, then it's necessary to for that subsurface estate to provide support for what's above. Does that answer the question?
Okay, but how does that not apply to this case, in your view?
Well, I think in this case, the court's going to have to construe that in light of 208. In other words, what does that mean? And we think the answer is this would apply in a case where the fee simple estate is not taken and the minerals are not taken.
Okay, just to pin you down a little further, you get that from the overall context, not from any language in 43.1.209?
Not really, because I think you almost have to read this in terms of the statutory scheme.
Okay, thank you.
Can I reserve what little is left for my rebuttal, or is there any more questions?
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Little. I'm appearing today as attorney for Antero Resources. Unless the court has any questions for me, I would like to yield the remainder of my time to Gibson Ranch to address the issue upon which certiorari was granted. Thank you.
Good morning. If it please the court, I'm Edward Mulhall, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Gibson Ranch. If I may, I'd like to point out a threshold question, and I think it bears on the certiorari. This action was brought in the district court by Gibson Ranch to quiet title to settle a disputed legal question. The issue was a narrow one: ownership of the Hunt property mineral estate. Cross motions for summary judgment were filed. Judge Boyd granted CDOT's motion. We appealed. The Court of Appeals, after examining the purpose of the condemnation and the 1975 condemnation petition, concluded that in this case, the eventual condemnation rule and order did not convey the Hunt mineral estate. That ownership determination was the heart, we believe, of the Court of Appeals decision. CDOT did not seek certiorari on the ownership issue, and that determination, we believe, is not before the court. To the certiorari question, Gibson Ranch's position is that in CDOT's or the department's 1970s condemnation action, the power to condemn for highway purposes is limited. It's limited in this instance to a surface roadway easement, highway appurtenances, and subsurface support.
Mr. Mulhall, may I interrupt you?
Certainly.
I was maybe then a little bit confused by your opening comments. Is what you're saying to us that you think the only issue before us is the broader one of CDOT's authority in general, but with respect to you, that issue has been settled because of the unique facts in your situation?
We don't think CDOT properly appealed the ownership determination, and this is probably not a correct or fair characterization, but this becomes essentially an advisory opinion of the issue that's now before the court.
I thought that's what you said. So it's your opinion that even if we were to hold that CDOT did have that authority, that it didn't properly exercise its authority in this particular eminent domain proceeding, but more importantly, the issue of whether it did or did not with respect to your client is precluded. It's not before us.
We would urge that the court consider that, because that was a concern of ours we had reviewing this matter for oral argument.
And by that you mean you would urge that we consider whether it did or did not have the proper authority?
Well,
I just want to make sure I absolutely understand your position, because this was something I was thinking about as well.
We would argue that the Court of Appeals decided Gypsum Ranch owned the mineral estate on the Hunt property.
Right.
And that is not an issue in this case.
Okay.
Oh, just remind me, what did Judge Boyd rule on that issue?
Judge Boyd ruled that CDOT owned the entire mineral estate, essentially, Your Honor.
See, my concern is perhaps the right thing to do is, you know, if we agreed with CDOT to return it back to the Court of Appeals to re-examine their decision, because it's not clear to me that the issues weren't tied together in their thinking. But, you know, that's not something we need to sort out right now. I would assume. Let's get on with the argument.
Thank you, sir. We believe that this case is a matter of looking at the historical perspective. First of all, what is the power of eminent domain? Obviously, it's a legislative power. The executive branch, the agencies, have no authority to create eminent domain powers, and certainly the agencies themselves are not in a position to expand their powers. And that authority is a basic thread that runs through this particular appeal. The history is the Colorado Eminent Domain Act, and we believe it is a substantive provision, was adopted in 1877. The Eminent Domain Act has its place in Colorado history because it was an adjunct of the counties for their ability to create roads. There's an article by Willis Carpenter, Mavra Madison before, that goes into the history of road creations in the state of Colorado. And eminent domain was one of the tools in that arsenal of road creation. But the original purpose for roads, that is, surface conveyances, never changed. The first state highway agency that was created was the Highway Commission, and that was in 1909. In 1917, with the Highway Department Organic Act, the department was created, and it was given the 1877 power of eminent domain, but for its statutory purposes. In 1921, the General Assembly adopted the highway law, and it defined a state highway as a right-of-way. From the 1917 Act until 1941, the department's power of eminent domain remained the same. With the advent of World War II and the creation of the Denver Federal Center, which was then the Remington Arms Plant, the department got the additional power to create freeways and limit access to them. And we've cited in our brief, I think, about 10 or so statutes where the General Assembly has described what the Highway Department has authority over for roadway purposes, and consistently describe it as a right-of-way. What is a right-of-way in Colorado? That's something that is popularly known from the ditches that we deal with all the time in water rights matters. And there are two decisions that we've cited in our brief, Morris and Farnick. I believe those are applicable in this instance. They define a roadway as nothing more than a surface right-of-way. We also cite Russell Cole, which was a case arising in connection with the Denver Boulder Turnpike when it was acquired. The question there was to determine the scope of the department's authority to acquire right-of-way. What did they get? Well, if they got the entire fee simple estate, there wouldn't have been the issues that there were in Russell Cole. Russell Cole directly addressed the highway's right to subsurface support.
Could I just interrupt, sir? Excuse me. Do you think that the reason that there were these issues was because they were not able, as a matter of statutory authority, to get fee simple, or because they just simply didn't buy the fee simple?
Or it was
unclear what it was they bought or condemned?
I don't want to tell war stories, but I've been trying condemnation cases for 47 years. And traditionally, a roadway is a right-of-way. I don't think it's up to the agency to determine what it is they want. It's the General Assembly speaking in terms of acquiring right-of-ways, which ties to their purpose. They have no purpose or no need for anything below the surface other than subsurface support. And those were given to CDOT after their general power of authority to acquire roadway rights away as a necessity, because I guess the General Assembly didn't want the roads falling into a hole in the ground.
Makes sense. Do you think that on occasion, obviously, they did buy fee, but you think that was just because there was fee simple, but that was just because there was consent between the parties, not because there was the implicit authority to take that fee simple?
I don't know what the internal practice in all instances in the Highway Department was. The one thing that I would note, that it has not been consistent, and there practices have changed. There was a law review or a Colorado lawyer article by a fellow named Penkovsky who pointed out that in the 1980s, the Colorado Highway Department's practices changed. This was noted by the Court of Appeals in its decision. And I have an illustration, if it would be of any interest to the court. I've reproduced it. And this is a form of deed that the Highway Department was using in the 1970s in this segment of cases between Newcastle and west of Rifle. That's the affidavit that Mr. Tannenbaum was referring to that we presented to the trial court. And the deed itself is rather illuminating in terms of what the practice was. It wasn't the Bradford Robinson form. It was a departmental form. I have copies if I could approach and...
Is that part of the record?
It is part of the record.
Well, you can submit it after the argument. Let's move along. I think this history is all very interesting, but let's get to the Court of Appeals opinion. Would you please turn to the analysis that the Court of Appeals did of the statute? I think that we're trying to construe here 38.1.105.4. Okay.
Pardon, I didn't hear your question.
I'd like you to turn to the Court of Appeals construction of 38.1.105.4, please, and tell me why you think that is consistent with the language of the statute.
Because they did trace the history of the Eminent Domain Act and its application.
You've told us all about the history. Now, would you relate it to the statute, please?
The statute requires that the purpose and the authority be stated in the Highway Department proceeding. And they criticized the rule and order because of basically a sloppy practice, and pointed out that the petition correctly complied with the statute, but the rule and order, which is ambiguous, did not. Hence the reason that they went to the statutes, and their interpretation was that what was authorized was a right-of-way.
Could you please direct your comments to 31.1.105.4 and tell me why you think the Court of Appeals correctly interpreted that statute? 38.1.105.4. Isn't that the key to the Court of Appeals decision?
The interpretation of it is, and it is what we believe is the pure question of law.
So please, if you could focus your comments on that.
My comments, I've tried to focus them going back to the 1877 Eminent Domain Act. And these things have grown up together. That is the present codification of the old civil code proceeding that still works in tandem with the CDOT's authority under Title 43 or 42, whichever it is. And what it was historically, we believe, has not changed in the present day. It stands today as it did then. And that, in turn, requires looking at what is the purpose of the condemning agency? What is their power? What is their authority? What is their purpose?
Council, maybe I can direct you to specific language. I mean, I guess your argument in Section 4, Subsection 4, is no right of way or easement, da-da-da-da-da. And isn't your argument that what was taken here was a right of way under the statute? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what you're arguing, correct?
We are arguing, yes, it was a right-of-way that was acquired because the right-of-way is all that was needed and necessary and authorized.
Okay, in this particular instance or just generally, I guess?
Generally.
Generally is just defining the authority of CDOT that if they take whatever they take, it is a right-of-way. Basically, and fits within that subsection?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I still don't exactly know your position because it seems to me the Court of Appeals is talking about the 2008 amendment and that the issue really then is whether they meant that to be clarifying of pre-existing law or not, or whether they were changing it. Right? I mean, the Court of Appeals just lands on the 2008 statute. Which is a significant additional statement they didn't make before. They never require a mineral interest, right? So you could either say, well, they're changing the law, or you could say everything that was acquired back to 1917 in fee simple is void, of no effect, and therefore threaten all the either the consensual fee simples or the ones that were paid for in taken in condemnation. So what's your position on how we ought to construe the 2008 amendment?
Your position, Justice Hobbs, is that Mr. Tannenbaum argued before the Court of Appeals.
Well, it's not my position. I'm asking you how, you know, explain your position in the statutory construction analysis, why we should consider this clarifying or why we should consider it a change or not consider it a substantive change.
I don't think there has been a substantive change. We believe it has been consistently a right-of-way all along. That's what we tried to establish by the instruments of conveyance between Newcastle and west of Rifle, that the 2008 Senate Bill 0841, all it did was, as in the preamble, was clarify. Because the question has arisen in several places in the state of Colorado as to what's been taken. That ties, I think, with the practice of the oil companies being safe. They'll take leases from whomever claims an interest. And fortunately, they're protected because they have their lesser interest clauses in the leases. If there's a title dispute, fellas, you get to fight it out. But the law, we believe, has been right away all along.
Why do you think
the amendment in 208 clarifies?
So why do you think if that was the law all along, there had to be clarification?
Well, I don't presume to speak for the General Assembly, but I would assume that the issue was raised with them, that there's a new wrinkle in what the statutes provide. The Eminent Domain Act, it's more than 100 years old. Maybe people found flaws in it, but the practice and the disputes that were arising as a practical matter probably suggested to them that something needed to be done. And what they did was clarify rather than remediate.
How come there isn't a reservation of rights by your client in this case? You know, that would simply, you know, state the obvious. You're stating the obvious that it was never deal to have fee simple, right? I mean, there was no intention in the petition and condemnation to have fee simple. So why don't we see the exception?
You should, if the practice by the Attorney General's office was the way that it should have been, what was in the petition and condemnation should have appeared in the rule and order, but it did not.
Well, why wasn't that raised in the condemnation hearing?
I didn't represent Mrs. Hunt in the condemnation hearing, but it was not the practice to do so because the petition stated what it was they were acquiring. It affects the titles, and that is bad practice, but it is of the record in the particular instance what it was that was acquired.
I have the petition in front of me. I know you probably don't, but from recollection, do you recall what language in the petition would have made it clear that they weren't taking the mineral estate?
Let me, off the top of my head, I do not, so bear with me. I thought I mentioned it in our brief.
I can look.
On page 3 of our brief, Justice Rice, I said the 1975 Hunt petition cites its condemning authority as chapters 120 and 50 of 63 CRS. The other allegations enumerate its purposes. The Hunt petition sought immediate possession to proceed with the construction of the highway improvement. It sought 4 parcels for use as a portion of State Highway Number 70, the construction of highway improvements. It alleged land being acquired for a limited access freeway, and it sought the landowner's rights of access across the right-of-way line.
That's in the order. Excuse me.
Basically,
isn't that in the order of possession? The building dealing with the order of possession, which would be different than the petition, because they had to get immediate possession to build it.
I'm sorry, Justice Bender, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry if I spoke too quickly, but I think you're reading from the immediate possession documents.
No, I was reading from the petition itself. I think it was on page 2 of the petition in condemnation. I was not reading from the order of possession.
I take it back.
If I've got a couple of minutes, bear with me, please, and I can perhaps answer a couple of questions that were raised earlier during Mr. Tannenbaum's arguments. Justice Hobbs raised this question about oil and gas leases and why a lessee was made a party to a condemnation proceeding. I think with the oil and gas leases, the lessee has a surface interest specified in the lease. So if the exclusive surface use and the right of access was being taken, then the lessee would have an interest in what in the area that he could not drill in. Justice Martinez raised the question as to what conveys title in a condemnation action. I believe the code, the condemnation statute specifically states that a rule and order once entered by the court of jurisdiction acts like a deed in conveyance. That's specifically language there. One point, and I think just as I had referred to it, and that was the Subsurface Act. if the highway department had an fee simple absolute estate from the heavens to the core of the earth, then there would be no necessity for the subsurface support statute.
Well, if you're requiring lesser than that, I mean, the highway department presumably could acquire less than that if they wanted to. I mean, that's why I'm a little bit concerned. You started opening out with the ditches, and if you just start there, there's a whole history in the land acts of just a right-of-way granted by federal land law for building a ditch, and it's well known that that isn't the rest of the estate, but it appears that we may have a different definition in Colorado law going on here since 1917 that would actually give them the authority for a greater estate, and then they would get to choose what kind of interest they want, less than fee simple or the entire fee simple. And then we have a change in 2008 that adds words to a statute, and I believe the construction, the canon that would apply would, if they add words, they're meaning a change in the law henceforth, not a retroactive kind of a change, right?
Well,
unless it's pretty clear that they're clarifying that there was not this authority previously. So would you comment on that? I didn't hear your answer to why Justice Rice's questions about why they needed to add these words that look pretty substantive, arguably.
I don't think clarify means amend. I think clarify means that they're making what was said previously more clear rather than amending and saying we're recasting the matter entirely again. And the words clarify, when they're taken in the historical context, in the context of actual use, mean that limited aspect rather than an omnibus overall amendment that puts it in a completely different posture.
Mr. Mulhall,
sir,
may I ask you, since we're getting down specific about 2008, what do you think the significance of the bill title is with regard to legislative intent?
I've forgotten what the title was.
Isn't that where the language about clarifying the bill summary or the bill heading? Those are not, or you tell me, are those drafted by the, are those part of the legislation? Should they be treated as an indication of what the legislature intends when it passes a bill?
I would hope so.
Are they done by legislative drafting? Do they get changed? Is that something that's voted on?
I honestly don't know what the procedures are so far as the preamble and the titles are concerned, I must confess.
And the reason I ask is sometimes we see a very clear indication that the legislature intends to be clarifying something that an earlier legislature did. And that will appear oftentimes in a legislative declaration. And oftentimes we'll be very specific. With this bill, we intend to clarify that we never intended what the court said in People v. Smith, you know, that kind of thing. That doesn't appear to be the case here. It seems, unless I'm missing some parts, and maybe you could help me out with that, but at least what the Court of Appeals relied on was some very, very cursory language, use of the word clarify, but not specifying whether it intended to clarify what the legislature intends now as opposed to what an earlier legislature intended, and not even apparently appearing in the bill, but rather appearing in a bill summary. And I was wondering what effect you thought that would have.
I thought it had a very simple effect. That would be my impression of it, Your Honor. And again, putting that in the context of this being a right-of-way, and the additional burden that is imposed in condemnation actions for subsurface support, we're now clarifying that the original right-of-way and the additional statutory burdens that we imposed, sticking that in both the Condemnation Act and the Highway Department's Organic Act in 1951, mean that they can impose roads, they're going to have subsurface support, but they don't get the mineral
So state. You take that as a pretty clear indication that this current legislature was saying, trying to clarify what the earlier legislature intended in passing a statute. Assuming that's true, may I ask you the follow-up question? What effect do you think that should have on us? Do you think this legislature can tell us what the earlier legislature intended?
No. I've been practicing for 50 years, and courts decide what courts believe the law to be. And certainly the legislature doesn't speak to the courts very authoritatively. I think they can indicate what they believe. And my remarks are what I believe the legislature was trying to do. That concludes my remarks, unless there are additional questions. Thank you for your patience.
If it pleases the court, I'll move right to that 2008 legislation. It's CDOT's position this was, without question, an amendment. Prior to 2008, CDOT's authority allowed it to acquire the lands of private persons. In 2008, 43-1208, paren 4, a brand new piece of that statute, never had existed before, said, yes, you can take the lands, but you can't take the oil and gas and minerals. That's an amendment. That is not a clarification. Now, Mr. Mulhall used a couple of words that I found interesting. When answering as to the operation of 38-1105 and the eminent domain statute, and mentioning briefly the authority, he said, well, these statutes work in tandem. That's something I have to agree with him on. Yes, they work in tandem, but we have to get, they're different. They don't mean the same thing. There is no eminent domain power. It remains dormant until the General Assembly says that it exists. Well, it was a statute created in 1877, the first General Assembly. It was an eminent domain statute. In fact, there's some cases in this court construing an 1868 eminent domain statute. The state and even the territory had the power of eminent domain, but there was no Department of Transportation in 1876. It didn't have any powers, didn't have anything. It didn't exist. There wasn't even a need. In 1917, it was created. And there would have been no eminent domain power unless the General Assembly had granted that authority, that right of eminent domain, and it did. So that's when the right of eminent domain for CDOT occurred. And that would have been in 1917. And that authority included bringing those proceedings under Title 38. There are a couple of cases Mr. Mulhall mentions, and Russell Cole is one of those, William Russell Cole Company. I wrestled with that case myself, and I know from the questions, it's not easy to tell what happened because the decision doesn't really tell you any details. It says the case was filed using the ordinary eminent domain language. Well, that really doesn't tell you much. It appears, and again, it's only an inference, it appears as if there wasn't an attempt to acquire the mineral estate. In fact, why would there have been? There was an operating coal mine at that point in time. That was the whole issue in the case. It wasn't, did CDOT have the power? It was a question is, I guess it would have been Department of Transportation at the time, could the department waive the subsurface support? That was really the issue in Russell Cole. It's hardly applicable to this case. We also have the Farnick case and the Morris case that Mr. Mulhall mentions. One has to really take a careful look at those cases. They're interesting in light of this case for a couple of reasons. One is those dealt with the authority of counties. And in fact, Farnick wasn't even a condemnation case. The question was, did the county have the power in its enabling statute to take the subsurface estate? The answer was no, it didn't. And consistently with that, Morris said the counties didn't. How are those applicable here? Well, they're not really applicable, but what they do is they point out how this court has consistently and always construed authority statutes, eminent domain authority statutes. You always look to the authority granted by the General Assembly. And it's not the same power, it's not the same authority for each agency, for each department. There are plenty of cases that indicate that. The IREA case, the Arapaho County case, clearly shows that. It depends on what the General Assembly has determined is the appropriate eminent domain authority for that particular department. The General Assembly here, 91 years before the 2008 amendment, said that CDOT has the power to acquire lands of private persons. That is a fee simple estate. Thank you for your attention.
Excuse me, there is no sir rebuttal.
I understand I made an offer of copies of documents, if I may.
You can leave them with the bailiff.
Very well.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments.